Everyone got a seat and comfortable? Well, welcome to the final Miliband lecture in this academic season. This is the sixth and last lecture, and it's a great pleasure to have you here this evening. There are very few academics, in my view, in the front line. That is, academics who take their work and research into the heartland of institutions, particularly into the heartland of global institutions. But this evening, it's a delight to have someone who has precisely done that. Currently, John Ruggie is the Kirkpatrick Professor of International Affairs at the Kennedy School of Government, Harvard. But from 1997 to 2001, he was Assistant Secretary General and Chief Advisor for Strategic Planning to Kofi Annan. During his time at the United Nations, I think it's not an overstatement to say that John's responsibilities included conceiving, designing, and managing the Global Compact, which promotes human rights, labor standards, and environmental principles in global corporate practices, certainly seeks so to do. In his lecture, he's going to reflect on the experience of this and on similar initiatives in the attempt to bridge global governance by means of multi-stakeholder efforts. Much of Professor Ruggie's academic work has dealt with the impact of economic globalization on global rulemaking and on the evolving global political order. He's published several very notable books, but two I'd like to mention in particular, Winning the Peace, America and World Order in the New Era, which was published in 1996, and Constructing World Polity, Routledge, 1998. He's, of course, the author also of numerous articles, many op-ed pieces, and TV commentaries, which he's offered around the world. So please join me to give him a very warm welcome. He's going to talk about the corporate connection to global governance this evening. So we're pleased to have you.
Thank you very much, David, and thank you all for coming out. I understand it's exam week, and so if some of you drift off, I'll know it's nothing personal, that it had to do with the fact that you were up all night studying. It's great to be here and to see so many friends of long standing. I almost said old friends, but when you reach my age, you probably shouldn't say that. It's also nice to see you here. Ambassador Amarim of Brazil, I think it's fair to say, saved Kofi Annan's reform package in 1997 from oblivion at the end of 1,000 pinpricks in the group of 77. If it weren't for him, I'm not sure that it would have survived. It's great to see you here, Salsa. Thank you so much. It's a great honor to be here in the intellectual house that Lasky built and to give one of the Miliband lectures. I'm not sure that either Harold or Ralph would approve of much of what I will say this evening, but I'll do my best to be persuasive in case they're listening from somewhere and want to join in the debate. I'd like to begin by referring to an article I published now some 20 years ago, a scholarly article that introduced the concept of embedded liberalism into the academic literature. That concept was intended to convey the story of how the capitalist countries learned to reconcile the efficiency of international markets with the needs and values of national social community. It was a lesson that the capitalist countries did not learn easily. In the Victorian era, the international side prevailed. That is to say, under the rules of the gold standard and free trade, national policy concerns with such factors as the level of employment or price stability were subordinated for the purposes of maintaining international stability and parity. In the period between the two world wars, the opposite was true. The unfettered quest for national policy autonomy undermined from the start any possibility of a viable international economic order and ultimately led to its unraveling. When we finally got the balance right, we called the new social understanding by different names in different places. In the United States, we called it the New Deal state or the Keynesian state. In Europe, it was known as social democracy or the social market economy. But the underlying idea was the same. namely a grand social bargain whereby all sectors of society agreed to open markets, but also to contain and to share the social adjustment costs that open markets invariably produce. And that was the essence of the embedded liberalism compromise. Governments played a key role in instituting and in sustaining this compromise by moderating the volatility of transaction flows across borders and by providing social investments, safety nets, and adjustment assistance, but all the while pushing international liberalization. In the industrialized world, I think we can safely say that this grand bargain formed the basis of what may well turn out to be the longest and the most equitable period of economic expansion in human history, from the 1950s to the present. And it provided the institutional foundation for the newest wave of globalization, which began not long thereafter, and which has wider scope and deeper reach than its 19th century antecedent. Now, I raise the issue of the embedded liberalism compromise this evening not out of some authorial pride, but to stress that we have to learn this lesson all over again, only this time in far more difficult terrain. Why is that the case? Because embedded liberalism presupposed an international world, but we've come to live in a global world. It presupposed the existence of national economies engaged in external transactions conducted at arm's length, which governments could mediate at the border by tariffs and exchange rates and other such tools. But markets have gone global, threatening to leave behind merely national social bargains. And of course, needless to say, the developing countries never enjoyed the privilege of cushioning the adverse domestic effects of market exposure in the first place. They've always been vulnerable. Now, the past is not inevitably prologue, but here is how Kofi Annan described the current state of play at Davos in January 1999. On the occasion of his announcing the Global Compact. This was some 10 months before the Battle of Seattle, as it has come to be known. Secretary General said, and I quote, "Our challenge today is to devise a similar compact on the global scale to underpin the new global economy. Until we do, the global economy will be fragile and vulnerable. Vulnerable to backlash from all the isms of our post-Cold War world. Protectionism, populism, nationalism, ethnic chauvinism, fanaticism, and terrorism." Now, the terrain today is far more difficult for the simple reason that there is no state globally that can step in and act on behalf of society. And so more circuitous, more indirect, and weaker tools are the only things that we have at our disposal if we attempt to embed global markets in shared values and practices in the attempt to stabilize their social consequences. Now, my remarks this evening are divided into three parts. First, I want to describe very, very briefly some of the main drivers of the anti-globalization backlash when seen from the vantage point of the embedded liberalism compromise. Secondly, I want to summarize the key features of Kofi Annan's Global Compact, which, as David has pointed out, enlists, or at least attempts to enlist, the corporate community in promoting human rights, labor standards, and environmental principles. And third, I want to locate that initiative, the Global Compact, within the broader universe of innovations in global governance. And I want to argue, with due appreciation for the irony, that the corporate sector, which has done more than any other to create the growing gap between global economy and national community also has a very significant role to play in bridging that gap. So let me just say a few words first about the backlash. It has many sources, but three negative attributes of globalization have animated particular concern. And I focus on negative attributes not because I believe that there are no positive ones, but it's the backlash that I want to talk about. First, the benefits of globalization obviously are distributed highly unequally, both within and among countries. Robert Wade gave an excellent lecture in this series just a little while ago. I need to say very little more about it. Large parts of the developing world have been left behind entirely. Africa, for example, is less integrated into the global economy today than it was 10 years ago. Half of Africans have never made or received a telephone call. And of course, Africa has the largest share of population living in absolute poverty in contrast to any other continent. Secondly, the backlash is triggered by a growing imbalance in global rulemaking. Very simply, and perhaps not entirely precisely, but those rules that favor global market expansion have become more robust and more enforceable over the last decade or two. For example, intellectual property rights or dispute resolution in the WTO. But rules that are intended to promote equally important social objectives, be they poverty eradication or human rights or labor or environmental principles, they lag behind and in some instances have actually become weaker. So we find ourselves in the anomalous position where rules concerning patent rights trump fundamental human rights and even human life, as was the case in the HIV/AIDS treatment issue in Africa, at least until that clash became unbearable for the world's conscience and the big pharmaceutical companies were forced to back down. The third driver in the backlash may well have the most widespread popular roots in the industrialized and in the developing countries alike. For many people, globalization has come to mean greater vulnerability to unfamiliar and unpredictable forces that can bring on economic instability and social dislocation with lightning speed, as, for example, in the case of the Asian financial crisis of 97 and 98, which was the fifth but not the last major international financial crisis in just two decades. The integrity of cultures and the sovereignty of states are increasingly seen to be at stake. And even in the most powerful countries, including my own, people worry for their jobs. They wonder who is in charge. And they fear that their own voices are drowned out by the massive sweep of globalization. On this last point, two Canadian political scientists from Queen's University, Matthew Mendelssohn and Robert Wolfe, have recently explored these fears in the Canadian public with a survey instrument that was designed specifically for this purpose. And it turned up some fascinating findings, some of which I want to share with you. First of all, they find that Canadians strongly support new trade agreements, 65% positive response, including a free trade area of the Americas, 67% positive response. But interestingly enough, Canadians are dubious about globalization, only 45% positive, and they fundamentally oppose ceding national authority over labor and workplace standards, only 27% positive, and even more so, standards for social programs, only 17% positive. Then Mendelssohn and Wolf tried to locate the sources of these attitudes, and they found that individuals' attitudes toward trade reflect their own sense of competitiveness or self-interest as economic agents. That is to say, their skill level. Highly skilled workers will tend to have more positive attitudes toward trade than low-skilled workers who are more afraid of losing their jobs. But here's the interesting kicker. Attitudes toward globalization had nothing to do. A very sophisticated regression analysis showed had almost nothing to do with self-interest. And it had everything to do with these individuals' sense of identity and with their core values about what kind of societies in which they wished to live. And for Canadians, as for many Europeans, the social welfare state is a core element of their sense of national identity, and they feared losing it. So to sum up effective responses to globalization's many challenges, responses that would help embed global markets in broader social values and shared practices, we'll have to make a dent on at least three disparities. First, income inequalities. Second, imbalances in rulemaking. And thirdly, citizens' fears of loss of control or accountability over values that matter to them, not only their interests, but also their sense of identity. Now, that is a very tall order indeed, almost a Herculean task, and it isn't going to be met easily. Let me shift, secondly, to Kofi Annan's Global Compact. As one very small exemplar of one, what I believe to be, and I would, of course, having been involved in it, innovative response to some of the challenges of globalization. Innovative in the sense that it attempts to speak to some of these challenges that I have just laid out. The compact encourages, as already indicated, the private sector to work directly with the UN in partnership with international labor, represented by the ICFTU, the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, as well as a dozen or 14 or so major transnational NGOs like Amnesty, to identify and to promote good corporate practices based on universal principles. Some 400 companies now participate in the Global Compact, with a surprisingly large number of firms whose home base is in developing countries, including Brazil, India, Thailand, South Africa, and several others. The Global Compact encompasses 9 principles that are drawn from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the ILO's Declaration on Fundamental Principles on Rights at Work, and the Rio Principles on Environment and Development. All of these are refashioned in order to make them suitable for the corporate domain, because, of course, they were initially intended for governments and implementation by states. Companies are challenged to embrace and enact these 9 principles in their own corporate domains. They're asked to move toward good practices as defined by the broader international community, as opposed to relying on their often superior bargaining power vis-a-vis states, particularly poorer and smaller developing countries. Let me quickly run through some of the things, the major things that companies are asked to do. First, very straightforward, to become advocates for the compact and its principles in public venues, including their mission statements, their annual reports, which typically require board approval, and so on and so forth. Secondly, to share with all Global Compact participants, including labor and the NGOs, at least once a year, cases examples that they wish to submit for collective scrutiny of behavior that they believe deserves the label good practice. The submission of those cases then triggers a dialogue among the various partners, including the UN experts, Amnesty if the issue relates to human rights, the labor unions, and so on and so forth. And the purpose of this dialogue is essentially to decide collectively whether this is indeed something that deserves to be labeled a good practice. If it is, it is posted on the Global Compact website and widely disseminated and promoted as a good practice by the United Nations. What does the company get out of it? The honor of having something that it has done be labeled collectively as a good practice, which presumably at least is a good marketing benefit for them. So both sides, at least in principle, draw some benefits from the deal. Thirdly, companies are asked to join with the UN in partnership projects of benefit to developing countries, particularly the least developed, which, as I've indicated, the forces of globalization have largely marginalized. And among the examples of projects underway are support for micro-lending, investment promotion, HIV/AIDS awareness and treatment for employees, devising sustainable alternative to child labor practices, and so on and so forth. Fourth and finally, companies on an optional basis are invited to participate in what the Global Compact calls policy dialogues, addressing key social dilemmas that involve companies and over which they have some leverage, and where it might be helpful to devise common understandings or recommendations. For example, the first such policy dialogue to get underway was actually initiated at the request of Shell and British Petroleum. I guess it's called Beyond Petroleum these days. They came to the United Nations. Essentially, BP came and said, look, we don't want to do in Angola, we don't want to end up doing in Angola what Nigeria did. What Shell did in Nigeria. Is there some way we could fashion a dialogue that would work out some common rules of the road for what the posture of a company should be when it operates in a zone of conflict, when it operates in civil war? And one byproduct of this dialogue, and I don't think the UN would claim sole responsibility for it, is that BP has made some moves toward far greater transparency in its payments to the Angolan government in the attempt to help reduce the probability or possibility of corruption in that country. Now, it's worth pointing out that the Global Compact for the United Nations is an entirely unnatural act. By which I mean that there has been no attempt to establish a centralized bureaucracy. The Global Compact was conceived and operates as a series of nested networks involving at the core the UN itself, the Secretary General's Office, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, the ILO, UN Environment Program, and at the country level, taking the global dialogues and principles local is UNDP, which is framing local compacts at the country level in now some 22 countries. As, if you will, sort of an open system architecture approach to international organization, the Global Compact has generated some very interesting and in some instances quite worthwhile spin-offs that were, quite frankly, not initially anticipated. Typically, they take a subset of interested Global Compact participants into new directions not necessarily implied by the minimum commitments that everybody is asked to undertake. So, for example, Norway's Statoil, the Norwegian oil company, and the International Federation of Chemical, Energy, Mine, and General Workers Unions, which is led by a very creative Brit, reached an agreement within the Global Compact framework whereby Statoil now extends the same labor rights as well as health and safety standards to all overseas operations that it applies in Norway. And that's a non-trivial step, given that they operate in countries such as Vietnam, Venezuela, Angola, and Azerbaijan. And the ISEM, the labor union people, do their best to monitor that the agreement is actually adhered to. My favorite unintended spin-off is with a multi-stakeholder committee for the city of Melbourne. The city of Melbourne, the community as a whole, is devising a strategic plan for the city, for its future. As part of that strategic plan, they've incorporated the 9 Global Compact principles and are asking all companies that operate in Melbourne to adopt the Global Compact and to implement it in their firms. I want to stress a point that has led to a good deal of misunderstanding and some honest disagreement about the Global Compact, namely that it was never conceived as a code of conduct. It is a learning forum. It was conceived as a social learning network, not as a regulatory instrument. And that was done for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that the General Assembly, in our judgment today, would be incapable of negotiating a serious and meaningful code of conduct regarding multinational corporations. The enterprise wouldn't be worthwhile doing. The product that it would yield wouldn't be worth trying to implement. But more profoundly, and I think this is a larger problem in the world out there in the transitional period in which we live, many of the Global Compact's principles simply cannot be translated into sufficiently discrete language that would have meaningful legal implications. For example, one of the principles is the precautionary principle. Enunciated at Rio in 1992 at the UN Conference on Environment and Development, that in the face of environmental uncertainty, the bias should favor avoiding doing risky things. Now, intuitively, we understand that notion, and I think intuitively we grasp it, but no one has been able to define it in legally meaningful terms. No one has a viable legal definition of the precautionary principle. You cannot ask companies to sign up to a code when you cannot yourself define the principles that you would ask them to endorse and implement. Similarly, with the whole notion of non-complicity in human rights abuses. I think we all agree, even most people at Shell would agree, that Shell had some responsibility for what went on in Nigeria, that Shell, in a certain sense, was complicitous. And the most egregious cases we can all define, but again, we don't know where to draw the boundaries. We don't know where to set the threshold. How far does the chain have to be removed from direct involvement before you can say, ah, yes, non-complicitous, we can certify that? Our hunch is, certainly my hunch is, that we find ourselves in these kinds of dilemmas more and more, which makes ex-ante standards and formal legal regulatory approaches, for the moment, less useful than what we describe as a social learning network, which essentially means that through trial and error and social dialogue and social vetting, you make the bet that as you move down the road, you begin to figure out what these things mean, or at least you develop sufficient consensus so that part of it can be fenced off and said, all right, this we can codify, this we still don't sufficiently understand. So that was the rationale for a learning network approach as opposed to a regulatory approach specifying ex-ante standards. So in sum, the Global Compact is a heterodox addition, and I do stress heterodox, to the growing menu of responses to globalization that seek to engage or to modify corporate behavior. A menu that now does include more than 240 codes of conduct, by one count, numerous social and environmental reporting initiatives, and various means to monitor corporate social responsibility. Now, there are a number of weaknesses in the Global Compact, and there are criticisms to be made of it, and I'll be happy to engage in that kind of a discussion after the lecture in the question and answer period. But for the moment, I'd like to leave the description of the compact there and move on to my third subject, which is to try to locate the Global Compact in the broader universe of innovative initiatives in global governance. And I would begin by reminding all of us of a fairly obvious point, that once upon a time, global governance, if the term was used at all, was entirely an interstate affair. Whether the instruments were alliances, international regimes, international law, international organization, states were the primary actors, and they were the primary objects of their joint decisions and their actions. That is, and certainly was, the foundational premise of the traditional system of global governance. What has changed profoundly in recent years is that actors and forces for which the territorial state is not the primary organizing principle have begun to outflank the state externally and to gnaw away at its governance monopoly internally, for better and for worse. These non-territorially based and inspired actors may be driven by universal values or factional greed, by profit and efficiency considerations, or by the search for salvation. They include multinational production networks and financial markets, civil society organizations, and such uncivil entities as transnational terrorist and criminal networks. I want to focus here on two of these social actors, civil society organizations and transnational corporations, and particularly on the dynamic interplay between the two and the transformational possibilities that this dynamic interplay offers us. On my side of the pond, the role of civil society organizations in international relations and international relations theory hasn't been fully figured out yet. I think you do somewhat better over here than we do. But in any case, real world players now recognize the involvement of civil society organizations in at least six different spheres of governance activity at the global level. Whereby recognize, I mean that the other social actors regard the participation of civil society organizations to be more or less legitimate, and in some respects, they actually count on civil society organizations doing certain things as they define their own strategic objectives and plans. Let me quickly run through these six governance roles and then elaborate on the last one. First, civil society organizations clearly have become the main deliverer, if you will, of direct services to people in developing countries, be it humanitarian assistance or foreign aid. Whether it's funded by a government agency or by civil society organizations themselves. USAID is no longer in the business of providing foreign assistance on the ground. It's a contracting agency. The actual services are delivered by civil society organizations. And I assume much the same is true for DFID. Secondly, civil society organizations play increasingly important roles in generating, deepening, and implementing transnational norms. As in the areas of human rights, the environment, and labor standards, and other areas, anti-corruption, for example. They do so through their own global campaign activities, as Transparency International does through the production of its Transparency Index. And they do so by direct involvement in governance forums, such as the UN's human rights machinery. Thirdly, and this is perhaps in some respects best known in the popular media, civil society coalitions have become a significant force in blocking or promoting international agreements. Two, of course, have reached iconic status. The most celebrated instance of a blockage being the torpedoing of the multilateral agreement on investment, which in some respects would have represented the high watermark of neoliberalism in the 1990s. And the most dramatic case of promoting a new agreement, even participating fully in negotiating in it, is, of course, the landmines ban, which was begun quite literally by two people with a fax machine and ended up, as my colleague and boss Joe Nye likes to say, ended up prevailing over the opposition of the most powerful bureaucracy in the world's most powerful country, namely the United States Pentagon. Fourthly, coalitions of domestic and transnational civil society networks perform critical roles in promoting human rights, environmental principles, and other social concerns within countries where progress in those areas would otherwise be blocked by official political channels. Via the so-called boomerang effect that was first identified by Margaret Keck and Catherine Sicking in their book, Activists Beyond Borders. Fifth, civil society organizations have become the main advocates of reform in international organizations, far more so than any government. The pressure to which the WTO is responding and the World Bank is responding, the IMF less so for a variety of reasons, is coming less from governments, in my judgment, than it is from civil society actors. Finally, civil society organizations have become a major force to induce greater socially responsible behavior in the corporate sector. Not by converting the corporate sector to a set of values other than profit maximization, but by exploiting the vulnerabilities of corporate brands to consumer pressures. And it's that last that I'd like to focus on for a few minutes, because that's where the global compact is located, the universe within which it is located. Transnational corporations have been obliged to negotiate scores of arrangements with civil society organizations, and also as a preemptive measure to adopt unilateral codes of their own or through their business associations. Gary Jareffi and his colleagues at Duke University call these arrangements certification institutions. They certify that behavior is in accordance with some agreed set of norms or standards. By now, certification institutions exist in most major economic sectors, including mining, forest products, chemicals, the oil industry, automobiles, as well as apparel and footwear. Their scope ranges from setting the floor on prices paid to family farmers growing coffee beans in Costa Rica, to ensuring that plywood originating in British Columbia or cashmere sweaters knitted in South China meet sustainable forestry practices or agreed labor standards. None of these is a universal code, obviously. They are adopted particularly by those economic actors, those firms, those marketing networks that feel particularly vulnerable because of the exposure of their brand. The investment community has shown increasing interest in certification institutions and in corporate social responsibility more generally. Amy Domini founded a social responsibility mutual fund a decade or so ago. She was all alone when she started. Today she has dozens of copycat emulators. Major pension funds, including America's largest, the California Public Employee Retirement System, have made socially responsible investment a priority. So trillions of dollars of investment capital are now involved and at stake. Now, despite their many other differences, these certification institutions do share one common feature, and that is that governments are nowhere to be seen in them. Civil society organizations view governments and intergovernmental organizations to be far too clumsy, too slow, too unresponsive to rapidly changing societal needs. And of course, companies prefer voluntary initiatives to legislated standards. It stands to reason. To date, governments, ironically, also seem to be perfectly content with this arrangement. It keeps them out of having to make tough decisions. And if there's one thing governments these days share, it's the avoidance of making tough decisions. Only a very small number of OECD countries, the UK, to some extent France and the Netherlands, have begun to encourage, let alone require, companies to engage in social reporting. And apart from voluntary OECD guidelines and the Global Compact, the intergovernmental arena has largely been silent as well. Now, this enthusiasm for certification institutions is matched, unfortunately, only by our collective ignorance of their effectiveness. We have done virtually no serious research yet to find out exactly how they impact on the people directly involved, let alone in triggering broader spillover effects in the societies around them. So a huge and enormous research task awaits us here. But for the purposes of tonight's discussion, I want to put that empirical dimension aside for the moment. And I want to draw attention to three more fundamental analytical implications of these certification institutions, on the assumption that they do have positive effect and will continue to proliferate. So it's an if-then proposition. If this is true, what are the analytical implications worth thinking about and trying to get leverage over? Now, I have three thoughts. The first is that the expansion of civil society organizations and the dynamic interplay with the corporate sector, particularly the transnational sector, is creating a for lack of better name, a functioning global social domain. Not merely an imagined social domain, but a functioning social domain. That is to say, a space that allows for the direct expression and pursuit of human interests, not only interests as mediated by states, which, of course, was the case in the past. What ended up on the international agenda in the international governance arenas were interests mediated by states. Here we have the possibility of a more direct expression and pursuit of human interests, not simply state-mediated interests. Moreover, this space reaches deeply into societies, and in fact, it affects some of the most intimately domestic aspects of social life. including the rights of individuals vis-a-vis their state and vis-a-vis their employer. And this space also links domestic social groups into increasingly dense transnational networks that operate in real time. The record for real time is probably the ambush against the multilateral agreement on investments. It involved something like 600 organizations in 70 different countries and was mobilized in 48 hours. Governments can't do that. And the United Nations certainly can't do that. This global social domain, in my view, potentially comprises rudimentary people-to-people links, including the corporate social responsibility initiatives. Now, we are a long way from turning consumers into global citizens. But insofar as consumers often knowingly pay more for certified products, it may be argued that the issues at stake, whether it's human rights or labor rights or whatever, do evoke deeper citizen-like values. Along the same lines, the employees of firms, especially transnationals, are another potential constituency for such proto-citizenship values, if you will. This is overlooked by activist groups who tend to black box corporations as adversaries, and by definition, anybody who's in one of them is an adversary. That's a mistake. The Global Compact, for example, has had its greatest successes in companies that fully engage their own employees in implementing the 9 principles. It turns out, lo and behold, that in addition to wanting a good salary and favorable working conditions, many employees also desire a sense of social efficacy for themselves and for their firms. And that's worth thinking about and trying to tap into. My second proposition concerns the nexus of public and private sector relations at the global level. I would hypothesize that the interplay between civil society and transnationals offers new possibilities for reconfiguring and rebalancing the public and private sectors at the global level. Some examples will help make the point. Corporate leaders in the social responsibility movement, Sir John Brown of BP, for example, who has been involved in this for many years and is, aside from that, an extremely smart individual. Leaders like John Brown have come to realize that the concept of corporate social responsibility is infinitely elastic. The more companies do, the more they will be asked to do. And you know what? They don't like that. Companies have already found themselves, including Shell in Nigeria, building schools, housing, hospitals, running a variety of social services in communities in which they operate, things in which they have absolutely no comparative advantage and really would rather not be involved in. So companies themselves have begun to ask the question, where is the public sector? It is no accident, my friends, as Ralph Miliband might have said, it is no accident that 3 elite global business groups, the World Economic Forum, the International Chamber of Commerce, and the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, recently launched governance initiatives. Initiatives intended to specify where private responsibility ends and public responsibility should begin. Similarly, the world's eyes were fixed on the large pharmaceutical companies as long as they stubbornly refused any compromise on the pricing of HIV/AIDS treatment drugs in Africa. But the minute they did, attention shifted to the public sector requirements of education, public health facilities, distribution networks, and on ways the international community can and should assist public authorities in the affected countries, with firms adopting an unusual public sector advocacy role. Obviously entirely out of self-interest, but interesting just the same. There should be no doubt in anyone's mind that this is fraught with possibilities for strategic manipulation and shirking. But the fact remains that it also embodies, in my judgment, considerable potential for public sector capacity building in developing countries and for rebalancing the skewed system of rulemaking in the global arena. But that won't happen by itself. And that's my third point. To make it happen requires policy entrepreneurs, actors or networks that tap into the realm of public authority. And here the Global Compact stands apart from all other so-called certification institutions. What is distinctive about it in this regard is, of course, the fact that it articulates universal values universally endorsed by governments, and that it involves the authority of the United Nations. The Global Compact is based, as I indicated, on principles that have been universally endorsed by governments, and therefore they represent as close to a common vision of a desirable normative future as the international system is capable of generating today. What the Global Compact does is to enlist companies to help bridge the gap between aspiration and reality. So in this respect, the Compact seeks to make the private sector an agency for the promotion of community norms. I said heterodox, and I meant it. But the Compact also serves as a bridge in the other direction, from the private sector back to the realm of public authority. Its products, whether good practices in implementing the nine principles, or the recommendations that come from its policy dialogues, like the one on the role of companies in zones of conflict, or the lessons learned from in-country partnership projects, those all feed directly back into the policy sphere, both at the level of the United Nations and in the countries where they take place. And in some instances, as I've suggested, the Compact's soft law practices, if you will, or understandings, can be expected to yield harder law outcomes down the road. So to summarize this last part of my remarks, the dynamic tension between civil society organizations and transnational firms is producing an expanding and deepening set of global social relations, a common global social space. But private certification institutions will remain small islands of progress unless their achievements are rooted in and generalized through the sphere of public authority. So let me conclude with four or five propositions for further considerations. I've already said that devising new institutional forms for attempting to embed global market relations in broader social values and practices is a monumental challenge. If we reflect back on how hard it was and how long it took for the industrialized countries to institute the original embedded liberalism compromise, one is led easily to conjure up very frightful scenarios of things to come. But the discussion, I hope, has also suggested some promising routes to explore, routes that seem worth exploring in the future. One idea that I would like to discard from right off the bat is the idea that somehow we have to further marginalize or constrain states if there is to be effective global governance. I think that is a fundamentally misguided idea. The territorial state is not going anywhere for the foreseeable future, not even in the increasingly integrated European context. There simply is no other entity that competes with or can substitute for the state. In fact, one of the core problems in global governance is weak states. Weak states that are unable to govern, and the last thing you want to do is to further undermine their ability to govern. What you must do instead is to help strengthen their capacity for their own sake and for the sake of our common global aims. In addition, there is no simple or single way to meet the challenges of globalization by creating new global bureaucratic behemoths. The existing international economic organizations are already far too unresponsive and intrusive. And from the vantage point of promoting social inclusion and social cohesion, which is my point of departure, the global economic organizations often intrude in entirely wrong-headed ways. But beyond that, the very notion of centralized hierarchies is an anachronism in our fluid and highly dynamic world, an outmoded remnant of 19th century mindsets. We are much more likely to succeed with agile global networks that more readily span existing institutions and jurisdictions, which can more readily shift or be reconfigured as circumstances change. I've argued that the emergent global social domain constitutes a key building block. There's broad consensus now that the growing reach of civil society organizations makes a positive contribution. But there's far greater ambivalence about the role of the corporate sector. And I've suggested that that too is a mistake. At latest count, there were some 63,000 transnational corporations with 800,000 subsidiaries and millions of subcontractors scattered around the world. They think and act globally, even as they are a decisive presence in small local communities. They're too important a global platform not to be part of the global governance solution. It may be a Faustian bargain, but I, for one, am willing to take the risk. I've suggested that they can ease the burden of public policy making by preparing the ground for it. They can help build public sector capacity. They can stimulate a recalibration of public sector and private sector imbalances such as exist today. And they can help pull the mantle of public authority into more global direction. And those are all critical elements of a solution. But when all is said and done, private deals can only take us part of the way. They cannot substitute for effective governance. Governance remains a public affair, even when, as is the case today, the constitution of the public is itself being redefined. So it was in the polis, and so it must be somehow globally. Thank you.
Well, let me start by thanking John for that enormously, I think, important and controversial talk. It's a superb mapping of the issues that we face in global governance, a superb account of the dilemmas between public and private authority, the role of corporations and the role of states and so on. And I thought it was enormously instructive and will give me certainly good goods to think with for a long, long time after I've left this lecture. So I think it was really a superb presentation. I'm very pleased to have been here to hear you. We have half an hour now, and I know I have at least 6 questions, but I'll only answer them if you're silent. So the floor is open, and please raise your hand. Do we have roaming mics as usual? Yes, we have one there and some at the back. Questions? Well, there's one at the back straight away, so let's take you. Yeah.
Hi, I was curious, a concern among civil society could be that it's common that when you have a very powerful state actor, when you have a very powerful non-state actor, say like a global corporation, and then you have a less powerful non-state actor, or a less powerful state actor like a very poor state that has less GMP than this corporation, it's common that there's a preference on the part of the more powerful actor for some sort of type of negotiation, whereas the smaller actor might prefer some sort of adjudication because they see that maybe they will gain more from it. And it seems to me that the global compact could be a form of a forum for negotiation. And I was just curious, in your analysis and assessment of the global compact, if you've taken account of this dynamic, the aspect of these inequalities of power, and the role of adjudication and negotiation in coming out with an outcome, taking into account like the legal and financial resources of the two parties.
Well, naturally, the imbalances of power are a very real and pressing factor that is always present. The idea behind the Global Compact is, however, precisely to communalize, if you will, the definition of good practice rather than leaving it to negotiations between a company and a potentially smaller and weaker state. The whole idea is to promote broader community norms for corporations to live up to, rather than getting away with less, which they could do if what they're asked to do is simply the product of a bilateral negotiation between the state and a transnational firm, which, as you point out, we've all seen the tables, you know, and how many transnational companies have market values or even annual sales that exceed, I don't know, the GDP of Denmark and God knows who else, let alone developing countries. But that's the whole idea behind the Global Compact, is to communalize to some extent that process so that it isn't simply the product of a bilateral power-based negotiation.
Several questions. Do you want to take clusters? Or just
whatever you
time?
Like.
We'll take two or three and then come back to you. Okay. Please. No, yes.
My question is as follows. Your solution on compact, or rather underlying argument in your lecture, was that there's been a fundamental change in global governance, and there are many institutions that outflank the state. You mentioned four of those: MNCs, financial markets, civil society, and transnational terrorist and violence organizations. Isn't it actually the other way around, that nation states actually, at least in terms of infrastructure, are still the main forces behind all of these forces, according to President Bush, even behind transnational terrorists and the violence organizations? And therefore, instead of putting deals such as Global Compact in another supposedly outflanking institution, actually what we should do is get states, and especially the powerful states, to use their coercive and bureaucratic abilities to coerce corporate companies to do what they have to do.
Oh, okay. No, I'm sorry. Okay, Robert, I forgot that we were clustering, yeah.
Well, let's take Robert. Yeah. Mike, down here, please.
Thanks. I imagine that a realist in international relations theory would predict that in 10 years from now, it will be very difficult to see any impact of this global compact. A realist would predict that this is just window dressing, because there's nothing in realist theory that would suggest...
That's their problem, though, not mine. Right?
There's nothing in realist theory which would suggest that this kind of stuff will have any causal impact. So my question to you is, what is the theoretical basis, in terms of what body of theory, do you think that this will indeed, in 10 years, 20 years, be, looking back, be seen to have had any impact whatsoever? What's the theoretical basis?
Let's just take one more question, then we'll get a question. There was someone over here, to the right? No? Yes. You'd like to take it? Comment.
Well, I was going to ask a question, but I think the other gentleman sort of addressed it, but I'll ask it anyway. A couple of years ago, Susan Strange argued that states were in a position where they had to bargain with firms in order to attract investment. Given your discussion of civil society organizations and what you see or what you seem to argue of for their increasing role, would you argue that states now also would have to bargain with them, or in fact would you even disagree with Strange and say that that was never the case at all anyhow?
So these are questions about the extent to which states remain or ought to remain primary and the theoretical basis of a view that there's a more plural basis to agency now in global order.
Well, I don't have any problem with the fundamental proposition that states remain central. In fact, I concluded with that notion. I guess what I would say is, if I try to visualize sort of a picture of how I see this working, is that you very much still have the system of territorial states and the system of international governance as we traditionally understood it, including regimes, alliances, law, organizations, and whatnots. But you also have this transnational overlay, a space that isn't controlled fully or in many instances even primarily by state-based actors. So you have a growing confluence of coexisting realities, not one substituting for the other, but as an overlay complicating things for the traditional system of governance. With regard to, let me just run through, that's by way of sort of a general response to all three. With regard to the first one, why don't states coerce companies to do the right thing? One of the big problems that we face in the world is the growing incidence of governance failures. We're inventing all sorts of new and different ways to do things precisely because governments refuse to do what governments are supposed to do all over the world, including in my own country. Take the case of fuel efficiency standards in automobiles. We haven't changed those in the United States since 1985. And we have a giant loophole in fuel efficiency standards, which are driven through by growing number of flag-draped SUVs. They're counted not as cars, but as trucks, and therefore don't require as high a standard of fuel efficiency. You think the American political system was capable, after 17 years of living with this loophole, of closing it? No. So, yes, governments should do all sorts of things, and governments should direct this, and governments should do that, and governments should not violate the human rights of their own citizens, and governments, including the government of Liberia, shouldn't be ripping off national treasure and killing its own people and stealing diamonds and buying arms and doing all sorts of other nasty things. Unfortunately, we don't live in a world of perfect governance, and therefore, if you want to make a difference, you've got to find a variety of means of, one, accomplishing tasks, and two, putting pressure on governments to get them to do the right thing in the longer run. As for realist theory, I think realist theory is very important. It's a very important anchor in the discipline of international relations, and I have never belittled it. I've shown due respect, except for some of the more outlandish claims made by people like John Mearsheimer.
But by and large, I think I've been relatively respectful of it, except for one fundamental blind spot. Realism has zero understanding of change. Realism has zero understanding of transformational potential. You go back and look at the realist arguments about the emerging European community, the emerging European integration. Go back to the late 1940s. It is meaningless. It's not going to happen. If it happens, it won't have any consequences. There'll never be a common this. There will never be a common that. Well, you know, where are we now? 2002. There's a lot of common thises and thats, which had no place in realist theory. And in fact, unfortunately, still don't have any place in realist theory, because one of the things realist theory doesn't do well, apart from studying transformation, is to learn from its own mistakes.
We've got several people who want to ask questions now. There's someone at the back, over in the back row. Your hand disappeared. So, okay, let's take the gentleman up there on the left, who has been waiting patiently. And then Paul Taylor. And, okay. We'll have several classes still to do. Keep your questions short. Yeah, please. Short and crisp.
How do you value the importance of peaceful and non-peaceful demonstrations by people against G7 meeting and World Trade Organization meetings? Can I have your comments, please?
That's a crisp question.
Okay.
Paul Taylor.
Could I also say how much I enjoyed John's talk, but as an old friend, I hope you'll forgive me of this particular question. In his remarks, there was a general implication of equal responsibilities and equal potentials for a wide range of actors, particularly the state. But if you would forgive this, if I ask the question, do you think that there's any truth at all in the view that there is a particular responsibility on the government of the USA for some of these problems? And does he think there's any truth at all in the idea that this is a jungle and that there are still battles going on here, and one of the primary creatures in this jungle is indeed the alliance of which the present administration in the States is a crucial part? I know this is a dangerous area, but I think that my question does reflect one of the sources of the anti-globalization movement. So I think it probably is an idea to pick at it directly.
Ambassador, are you going to follow this?
Thank you, John. It was excellent listening to you. It was an extremely interesting presentation, and of course it will continue to provoke thoughts for a long time. I just want, this being a Miliband lecture, maybe I could put a somewhat Milibandish question, and that has to do with...
Can you swap mics?
You've got to get different
hopefully
mics.
Hopefully it'll improve the sound. Thank you.
I think I can.
Well. Just speak.
Okay, well, I just would like to ask you the question of the source of legitimacy, because this is a question that very often bothers me. Being very much involved in what you referred to, which was the question of medicaments and the TRIPS agreement, for instance, I have to pay tribute, for instance, to Oxfam, which was one of the key partners with countries like South Africa, Brazil, African countries, and so on, in what we achieved in WTO. So I recognize that. On the other hand, there is a question of what is the source of legitimacy for these actors that are able, as you say, to take decisions very rapidly, precisely because they don't have to account to parliaments and other things that governments have to. And the same question could be put and presented to the United Nations itself. What is the source of legitimacy after Kofi Annan leaves? Sometimes he will leave, I suppose, I don't know, for the Global Compact. Was it approved or taken note of in a General Assembly resolution? How do you intend to take that forward? Thank you.
With regard to demonstrations, I think they're in many instances a good thing unless they're aimed at me. I was actually the poster boy for a fundraising campaign by an activist organization which had my picture on their website, and it said, "Stop this man from corrupting the United Nations." The corporate sector, as I say, has, I wouldn't expect it to become driven by different kinds of interests or different kinds of values. They're there to make money. They're there to maximize return on investment. Now, they can define what that means in different ways. I referred to the California Public Employees Retirement System. CalPERS is the acronym for it. The head of CalPERS, you know, they own stock in a lot of companies. He's been going to various board meetings promoting the idea of what he calls patient capital. In other words, capital that isn't decisions in companies that aren't simply driven by the next quarterly report. European companies have tended to be better about that sort of thing than American companies. But that's an example of how one might redefine the way in which corporate interests are calculated. One can stretch the time horizon. I've heard people in companies say, you know, there are 1 billion people companies, i.e. those that are satisfied with serving the billion people in the world today who can afford their products. But companies that are in industries that have a long time horizon also think about the other 5 billion or, you know, in 15 years, 8 billion, and whether where they are going to get the resources to buy the products of those companies. And they realize that their own long-term strategic plans require them to take positions on certain issues, like the affordability of drugs, for example, which they otherwise might not. So it is possible to some extent to redefine corporate interest, but you're not going to change it fundamentally. What you can do is to exploit the vulnerabilities, and that's really what this game is all about. One of the great ironies is that companies bought returns that they never dreamed of through corporate branding. It also turns out that that is a major source of vulnerability for companies, and the chain of logic sometimes is very circuitous. The forest products industry is a fascinating example, where activist groups went after the timber companies, Weyerhaeuser and Georgia-Pacific and others in the United States. I don't know who they are over here. And of course, the average consumer has no idea who these timber companies are, and they don't buy anything directly from them. So the activist group says, wait a minute, this isn't working. We're going to start picketing Home Depot. Do you have Home Depot over here? It's a huge chain of home improvement supplies. They sell plywood that they buy from the timber companies. Now, Home Depot didn't want to get in the middle of a squabble about sustainable forest practices. And they said, okay, we sign on. What is it that we should require of the people who supply us to get you out of our parking lot, to get you and your picket signs out of our bloody parking lot? And they reached an agreement, and the Sustainable Forestry Initiative was the product, as a result of which companies that you couldn't reach directly, you began to reach through a middleman, as it were, who in turn put pressure on the original source of the problem, namely unsustainable forestry practices. So that's the dynamic. The dynamic is to play on companies' desire for decent PR, to avoid having picket lines in their parking lots, to have upscale shops like Bloomingdale's or Saks Fifth Avenue and Harrods, I guess, in the UK, not be accused of selling products that resulted from child labor or what have you. That's the game that this is all about. It's not that the corporate sector is going to be somehow fundamentally reformed. And demonstrators, to get back to that question, which I think is a good one, are, of course, a key ingredient. If it weren't for social activist pressure, relatively little would be happening. I'm not quite sure what exactly Paul Taylor wanted me to say in response to his question. I didn't come over here to defend the Bush administration. I don't do that at home, and I'm not going to do it here. I would only remind you that the president did not win the popular vote, which suggests that fundamentally he does not reflect all of what America stands for, that the jungle and the battles that you talked about are as lively inside the United States as they are globally. In fact, there are huge battles inside the administration over all major decisions. Unfortunately, unlike a president like FDR, who could play off competing channels of information and advice very effectively for his own purposes, Bush hasn't yet quite got on top of that process, shall we say. I well remember his being asked by a reporter in the last campaign to describe his understanding of globalization. And he said, well, it means that more and more of our goods are coming from foreign countries. Yes.
And legitimacy, briefly.
And legitimacy, that's a tough one. There are some people for whom this expression of civil society that I described here is, in fact, a sort of an emergent demos. I'm not one of those. I don't see anything particular democratic about the organization of most civil society organizations. I would use the term pluralism, however, that as a result of their participation in the political process, these voices are now being heard that weren't heard before, and interests are being articulated that weren't articulated before. And on the whole, I think that's a positive development, but I think we are a long way from achieving any kind of, if you forgive me, David, any kind of cosmopolitan democracy.
Most people here agree with you. So
as a result of the emergence of civil society or organizations. And I think for the time being, their legitimacy comes from the product of their work rather than from any representational structure or even particular transparency about how they operate or where their funding comes from. Or it's very much a results-based thing still than any other mode. And by the way, I forgot that Robert also asked about not only about my criticism of realism, but what theoretical perspective that I do draw on. And I think you know, I'm a self-described constructivist. As Marx said, you know, we do make our own history, even though it's not entirely as we please. We look for opportunities, we look for points of vulnerability, we look for points of leverage, and we grab them with whatever weight we can and try to channel the flow of things in more positive directions. It's a very simple, although not a realist, view of how the world operates.
Liz, can you take just one small final cluster, because we'll have to stop quite soon. I'm going to go to just, this is fairly arbitrary, because I try to keep track of who put their hands up first, but the gentleman over here has been waiting, and then we'll take one or two more here in the center. Anybody upstairs desperate for a question? You have a lot of friends.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
Professor Ruggie, it's more of an observation than a question. But you mentioned that various corporations actually go to less developed countries and actually do things like building schools, etc., which they'd rather not do. I would argue that these people who do such things, and I can give you an example of BP, a little town of Baglan in South Wales, setting up a place called Baglan Energy Park. Now BP are actually leaving Baglan, but they've actually set up a job centre on that site to relocate people into different jobs. We've got even local councils in England now. When, for example, a supermarket such as Sainsbury's wants to build a new supermarket somewhere, they may pay for the local CCTV for the local high street or something. My argument would be that these people don't do it for the love of or something that makes them feel warm and fuzzy inside. They do it because basically they're going to get some reputational dividend out of it. I mean, I work for ING, and basically we're also putting in place now a document that is basically saying ING and society, examining our relationship with people in general, presumably so that we'll get more people applying to our company and get more human capital in order to generate profits in the long term. So I don't think the motive is anything other than profit. It just may appear so.
Thank you. Lady over here. Just two more questions, I'm afraid. I'm sorry about this. It is, if in case you think it's arbitrary, it is. Thank you.
Hi, I just have a quick question, really. It's of interest to a lot of people who are doing the institution's paper on Monday.
we can chat later.
Sure. I was just wondering, what was the corporate connection with regard to UN reform? Because I've done a lot of reading, and basically a lot of the people, like Joseph Connor, he said that we can't apply streamlining and management to the UN because it's not a business. So what, briefly, is the corporate connection here, and how can businesses help to reconstruct its finances?
Say that last thing again.
How can businesses help reconstruct its finances, the UN financial structure?
Fine. And finally, over here. Lady over here. Yeah, I'm sorry, it'll have to be the final question.
My question is on financial reporting of companies, particularly transnational ones, because I've worked in Nigeria and seen what Shell has done to Delta State in Nigeria. And people there with very little idea of the size of Shell or the profits of Shell overall. Or look at Lesotho, the men going off to work in the gold and the coal mines of South Africa, returning with a heavy illness burden, but no notion of what those companies in South Africa, what are their profits, what's their turnover. And another example, Bangladesh. The tea estates up in the north of Bangladesh, some of them still in Scottish ownership. And again, people there having very little notion, what's the size of the company? Is it linked with others? Is there transfer pricing going on? So my first point is the need for corporate reporting, which is simple and can be understood by people in other countries. And to link this with, do you have lessons to give us out of Enron, that this great corporation has managed to produce these fictitious accounts in the United States with auditors to hand, Arthur Andersen, which had a good reputation in this country, and now we hear, you know, they've been pulling the wool over our eyes. So, two parts to the question.
Can I, yes, just throw in a couple of thoughts in by way of just final remarks. One is about agency structure and the other is about public-private. On agency structure, I mean, the social compact arguments you've been presenting, I'm very sympathetic to, so let me make that clear. But agency and responsible agency can only go so far. I mean, the difference between a rogue state and a non-rogue state matters. The difference between a rogue corporation and a non-rogue and a socially responsible corporation matters. And the compact pushes towards a definition of, in some sense, of what corporate responsibility would be. So at the level of agency, it seems to me important, and the emphasis on learning is important as well. But there's system limits. Mm-hmm. Those system limits are defined by shareholder value. Mm-hmm. There's a bottom line. And if social responsibility collides with tough investment decisions, you know, how will the balance fall on the side of social responsibility as opposed to the bottom line? In other words, if you don't have your diverse stakeholders represented in the bottom line, systems of accounting which reflect that diversity of interests, then companies will, in the end, to protect their long-run interests and their shareholder value, have to protect that base. And that suggests to me that the issues here are not just agency-based, but they're structural-based as well. And the corporate compact doesn't really specify how one locks into those deeper structural issues. That's the first reflection. The second one is, couldn't you argue, and I'm not going to make this argument because I don't really believe it, but couldn't you partially argue that this whole trajectory is a sign of public sector weakness? Mm-hmm. It's a sign that markets have gone too far, that deregulatory economic power since the 1970s, Big Bang and all that, have put the public sector on the defensive. But it seems to me that your argument actually seems to imply some sympathy with that defensiveness, because you were very quick to point out that your argument is not in favor of building up IGO capacity. It wasn't in favor of creating new IGOs, let's say, which are environmentally based or have a function protecting social core issues. What we have now is a world of market-driving IGOs, the WTO, the World Bank, and so on. But what we don't have is offsetting welfare IGOs concerned with social protection, the environment, and so on, with real teeth. Your argument seemed to suggest that going down that road, or campaigning for that road, or put pressure in that direction could be a mistake, because that creates more monoliths, leviathans, and we all know where that goes. Okay. Two questions.
Yeah, really simple ones, too. Let me begin at the end and sort of work back. One of the problems with trying to sort of circumscribe a subject in a lecture is that all sorts of things don't get said. And one of the things I would want to stress more than apparently I did is that I don't view any of this as a substitute for effective governance, either at the national level or at the global level. The whole purpose of what we're up to is to generate greater pressure for effective governance and to utilize the dynamic interplay between different social actors as a vehicle to promote more effective governance solutions, including public sector capacity building, particularly in developing countries. Public sector weakness is very pronounced in many developing countries, obviously, and by definition, it's true at the global level. I mean, the global level is, you know, the public sector, such as it is very thin. And that relates to your second question, how do we make it more robust? And I think I don't want to leave with a misunderstanding that I think the ILO, for example, on the issue of labor, has a critical role to play, but it is now utterly hamstrung by its own internal tripartite structure, which may have made great sense 50, 60 years ago, but as sort of the international expression of corporatism at the national level, but makes very little sense today. And somehow the ILO has got to escape from its own constitutional structure to become more agile and more effective as an organization. Not that we could do without an international labor organization. We just need a more effective one. Similarly with the global environment entity. When Maurice Strong first started UNEP back in 1972, I mean, he exaggerated hugely, but he went around visiting governments and saying, you know, Maurice Strong was the first person in my experience to sort of invent and articulate networked solutions to global governance problems back in 72. He said, we don't want to establish a big international institutions. We want to get tentacles into all sorts of other institutions that whose decisions are terribly significant for the environment, and to reshape them and to harmonize them at a global level. And you can do that more effectively with a network approach rather than a standalone organization. So you see what I'm saying? It's not the issue has to be dealt with at the global level and in a very robust way. I just don't think that if you cut a little piece out and call it environment and establish a big international organization called the World Environment Organization, that you've accomplished very much. The idea is to change the behavior of a whole multitude of other actors, not to create a new institution. And if changing the behavior of a multitude of other actors happens to involve creating a new institution, fine, then so be it. But you oughtn't to begin there. At best, you ought to end up there. Now, with regard to the limits on this kind of the dynamic between the private sector and civil society organizations, the limit ultimately being defined by shareholder value, I think obviously you're correct. And I would not say anything differently, except there are a couple of things that I would add. One is that it turns out that different companies have very different understandings of what that means. They can be in the same industry. They can have the same market power. Take ExxonMobil and BP on the issue of climate change. They both are major global players in their industry. It's an oligopolistic industry, and they are leading players in it. Both organizations are run largely by petroleum engineers, right? So that sort of organizational culture isn't a big difference. So you don't have industry sector as a difference. You don't have industry structure as a difference. You don't have institutional culture as a difference. But by God, those two organizations are as different as night and day. BP is one of the major corporate drivers behind climate change policy. It was a strong supporter of the Kyoto Accord. And ExxonMobil is going around saying it doesn't exist. Right? Climate change is not a problem. And applauded profusely when President Bush came down on their side. So obviously these two companies have very different conceptions of what it means to maximize shareholder value given the issue of climate change. And I think the trick is to find out what it is that makes a BP tick and to see whether that can't be disseminated. And also ways to figure out how to clobber ExxonMobil and get it to behave in a more responsible way. So what you call structure here is indeed a structural factor, but there are also very different corporate understandings of what these things mean. With regard to the question on financial reporting and Enron and all the rest of it, I don't claim to be an Enron expert. The point that I want to say about financial reporting and social reporting, which I think is tied in with the question, is that it too is an expression, a reflection of what it is governments insist companies do. The United States regulatory regime has become extremely lax over the last 10, 15 years. We went around the world proclaiming the superiority of the American model of accounting standards and God knows what else, even while it was rotting from within. We've had still a very hard time making the right decisions in the Congress, and let alone the administration, on what should be done, although slowly the Congress is getting a little bit more courage, fed no doubt by public opinion surveys. But with regard to the question on a company like Shell, Shell last year was the first company, I think, in the world to publish in the same booklet its annual financial report and a social report. Nobody else, to my knowledge, has done that. And that's an important development because now the investors in the company who obviously read the financial report also will get a social profile of the company. Governments, including the Dutch, are now requiring companies to do social reporting. Be a terrific thing for the UK government to require. Be a terrific thing for the US government to require. Again, there's lots of scope for governments to get in on the act here if they would only do so. So financial reporting, yes, needs reform. I think to further some of the issues that I was addressing, social reporting is also very important, and it ought to be part of the financial reporting so that it doesn't get isolated. All right, this is the social report. We're going to give that to Oxfam, whereas the investment community gets only the financial report. They ought to be integrated. Corporate connection and UN reform. Ambassador Amorim is the world's authority on UN reform. The UN's budgetary system is so far away from reflecting any definition of rationality that any human being, whether in the private sector or the public sector, would care to articulate, that I think we're a long way from emulating any sort of innovation. We do well if there is a vague connection between programs and budgets, between income flows and expenditures, and very sort of basic things, you know, that every household tries to adhere to. I'm exaggerating a bit, but not a whole lot. Finally, with regard to what should companies be building schools and all the rest of it, I haven't been to Wales in a while, but I wouldn't include it as a developing country, and I was referring primarily to developing countries where I have a real concern with what you might call decapacitation. I think there's a real need for capacity building in developing countries. And I don't think international actors, above all private sector actors, ought to substitute for what should be public sector functions. What we ought to try to get them to do is to help build capacity. And if that means building a hospital on a turnkey basis and then, you know, training people to run it and providing some support for it, that's fine. But I don't think I want Shell or any other company running schools and hospitals in developing countries. I want the governments in those countries to do those things.
Well, thank you. That's a good point. Well, as I said in my opening remarks, this was the last of the Miliband lectures this year. It'll be a hard act to follow, but we will follow it on in the next academic year. So watch out for the spaces that advertise it, and we're going to try and develop a series of programs, series of public lectures on American power in the 21st century. But that's for after the long summer recess. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.